welcome to the splendor, the spectacle, the sparkling sensation, where the romance, the comedy, and the thrill of Disney fantasies come to electric life.
And as our friend Jiminy said, welcome. Welcome to the Disney Nerds Podcast, a place each week where like-minded people get together to discuss all things Disney. We'll help you get your Disney fix on. Here we go.
A Magic Kingdom proudly presents, in a million points of musical light, the magical worlds of Disney.
Hello and welcome to the Disney Nerds Podcast, episode 134. This is Jennifer, and I have Sam with me on the line. Sam, how are you?
I am great, Jen, and I am so ready to just get started. So who do you have today?
I know, because we have the one and only Mr. Jim Korkus. Jim, how are you this evening?
Oh, gosh, thanks. I'm great.
I'm like giddy just talking to you. I love that you're on. So.
Thank you. That's a great opening. I have to tell you, Jim, the ultimate Disney nerd. I mean, you started this whole thing for so many of us. Thank you.
Well, you're more than welcome. I just happen to be in the right place at the right time. And if you're around long enough and you pay attention, you learn a couple of things. Like, gosh, you'd be goofy not to listen to the Disney Nerds Podcast.
Oh, my goodness.
That is great.
Well, you say you're in the right place at the right time, but I still feel like, I don't know. So we were looking back at, you know, as Sam mentioned off the air, we get, you know, Disney files and anything basically that comes in that might have an article or a piece from you. We flip right to it because we know it's going to be good. But you grew up in Glendale and you say you just happened to be at the right place at the right time. But I don't think that you just get to talk to some of the most influential people in Disney company. How what else did you do, Jim Korkus, that made you the right place?
Well, some of it is you have to be so stupid that you don't know that you can't. And again, I was growing up in Glendale, California, which is adjacent to Burbank, which is, of course, where the Disney studios are. And as a kid, like so many people, I was just enamored of the weekly Disney television show, especially the episodes that were devoted to animation, because that was just amazing to me. And so when I was watching the episodes on the credit roll at the end of each episode, I would take my school notebook and, again, about 12, 13 years old, and scribble down as quickly as I could as many names as I saw, and then went to the Glendale Burbank phone book, because Glendale and Burbank were small enough in those days that they shared one directory, and I just started looking up these names and cold calling them, and about 80% of them were just, you know, wonderful. 15% felt that this was just, you know, some sort of gag that, you know, their friends had set up, because it was quite common for, you know, animators and all to play pranks on each other. And then about 5% or so were wrong numbers. But fortunately, one of the very first people that I called was Jack Hanna, a Disney legend who lived in Glendale. And at the time, he was teaching at California Institute of the Arts, and he was raving about this young student he had in his class, John Lasseter. And he told me, you know, that guy's going to do something. You keep an eye on him. And Jack, of course, had worked as an animator at Disney and as a story man with Carl Barks. He was teamed as a partner with Carl Barks. And, in fact, the two of them did the very first Donald Duck comic book. And he was a director on a lot of the award-winning Donald Duck shorts. And then he transitioned to directing some of the intros with Walt for the weekly TV show, and then eventually, you know, he retired, but he was brought back to teach character animation at the Disney Institute, not the Disney Institute, the California Institute of the Arts, and he said, yeah, why don't you come on up and talk, and so we arranged this for a Saturday morning because, of course, I was in school for the rest of the week, and I had my mom drive me up there, and I was in my Sunday school suit, which was black and a thin black tie, so I looked like the youngest undertaker in the entire world. And she dropped me off there at the address, and I had my school notebooks, and I had this bulky tape recorder, but I had arranged to get there early because I didn't want to get there late, but I got there an hour early, so I didn't want to disturb, you know, Mr. Hanna, so I figured, well, I'll kill some time. I'll walk around the block. You know, that'll, I know where the house is now. I can do that. So I did that, and that didn't kill enough time. So I turned around and walked the other way around the block. And then I did it a third time. And by then, it was about 10 minutes before the meeting time. So I remember this very clearly as if it was yesterday. And there was an incline up to the house and a series of steps. And I went up there and I rang the bell, and his wife came to the door, and I said, "Mrs. Hanna, I'm Jim Corcus, and I have an appointment to talk with Mr. Hanna." And she turned to the living room and yelled and goes, "You're right, it is him." And Jack came out, and he's in this short sleeve Hawaiian shirt type thing, and he goes, "Yeah, we've been sitting here for an hour watching you out the window, wondering when you were going to come on up."
That's awesome.
And so, yeah, so went in, set up the tape recorder, and again, in those days, you know, this is pre-internet, you know, you didn't have a lot of resources to pull from. And so even though I knew he had worked on Donald Duck, I didn't know other things that he had done. And so, you know, I tried to configure questions, you know, to get this up. And again, I think he figured and I figured that this would be maybe a half hour, you know, 45 minutes type thing. 3 hours later, his wife came in and said, is Jim staying for dinner? And I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so." And Jack says, "No. I had great fun. I had great fun doing this. And you know, you should be talking to." And he picked up the phone and he called Ward Kimball.
Oh my goodness! Yeah.
And he said, "Ward, I got this kid here. He's really interested in animation. You should be talking to him. I'm going to give him your number. You know, you guys get something set up." And of course, I went back and talked with Jack many times over the years. And of course, he worked for Walter Lantz after he left Disney, and worked for Bob Clampett, so I interviewed him about those type of things. But that just really opened a door for me. And what happens now is remembering that graciousness and kindness, I try to repay that now so that when I get contacted by people, I try to do my best either to answer their questions or direct them to someone who might have that answer. You know, as minimal payback for how nice people were for me in the beginning there. And it again, I started writing for my school newspaper and the local newspaper, the Glendale News Press, and so they would do these little, you know, small feature articles, you know, the Donald Duck's daddy lives in Glendale, you know, type thing.
That was based on the conversations that you were having.
Yes, yes.
People. So that became the article that you wrote. So you were already at that young age creating this portfolio of stories about Disney.
Because wow. I was too dumb to know that somebody that young shouldn't be doing that.
I love that. That's so cool.
You know, because, again, when you're young, I think the impression is, why don't these old people just die and get out of the way? I know what I'm doing. You know, I could do this.
that's too funny. That boldness is something, you're right, that only young people, I think we lose that sometimes, don't we?
Yes. I think as we get older, suddenly we become more aware of consequences. Mm-hmm. And you know, oh, well, maybe this is inappropriate, you know? And so kids, you know, can pretty much get away with just about anything, you know, because, again, people will go, oh, they're young, you know, they'll learn, you know. Mm-hmm. When you get to be as old as dust as I am, now I'm in that situation where people goes, well, he's old enough to know better. Why is he doing that? So you just have to, you know, take it as it can. I found that just about every Disney historian that I know that I've talked with, Leonard Maltin is a good friend, for instance, all started the same way. They had that curiosity about something about Disney. They couldn't find the information, and so they had to go out and research it and find it on their own. And thank heavens that most of these people then shared it with the rest of us, because Disney history is like a huge jigsaw puzzle, you know, and all of us have little pieces. So if we share our pieces, it encourages other people to share their pieces, and sometimes things connect and you get a bigger version of the entire picture. You go, oh, I didn't know what this was, but now that somebody has put this piece right next to it, I see this is a bird. Oh, okay. This must go up over here. And what's exciting to me is that there are so many young people today who are interested in continuing that, because there's so much to know about Disney history. And again, Disney history is happening right now. You know, thank heavens that 20 years from now, you know, people won't be coming and asking me about, well, tell me about Marvel, tell me about the Muppets, tell me about Star Wars, because that's now all part of Disney history. And 20 years from now, a Disney historian is going to have to know that stuff and how that connects with the rest of the company. Mm-hmm. And then, thanks to the internet, thanks to all of this research being done by so many other people, there's so much that is being discovered every single day. Well, this year marks the 50th anniversary of Walt Disney passing away. That's you amazing. Would think in 50 years we would know just about everything there is to know about Walt Disney. Every day something new is. Last year, Sam Genoway, a friend of mine who writes about Disney and the Disney parks, ran across some Retlaw documents that were going to just be tossed away by this guy. And he turned to Sam and said, are you interested in it? And Sam said, yes, 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 yes. And one of the things that those documents revealed was that in 1956, and remember, Retlaw was Walter spelled backwards. That was Walt Disney's own company. And Retlaw is the one that owned the trains that went around Disneyland.
That he leased to Disneyland, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so here in these Retlaw papers, it showed that on every Saturday in 1956 at 2 o'clock, and it was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon because it had to be after lunch breaks for the conductors and all of that, Walt would go and tap out the engineer, and he would drive the train around the park for a couple of hours.
That would be so fun to just ride.
And nobody knew. Walt had his own set of overalls and hat and all in his apartment right above the firehouse on Main Street. And in 1956, this guy's spending the weekend out there playing with the trains. And that doesn't appear in any book. You know, there's oftentimes a reference of, well, Walt probably, you know, drove the trains every now and then. But here's physical proof that he did it every day at 2 o'clock in 1956.
Every, you know, Saturday at 2 o'clock in 1956, Walt is playing with his train set.
Yeah,
and nobody
and
knows
so,
it. Like, they're on the train and they don't know it. That's funny.
They don't know it.
That's crazy.
Because, again, Walt is playing engineer. He's mm-hmm. not Walt Disney. He's the engineer of the train, and so he's making sure that the water, you know, gets into the into the boiler, and that, you know, everything is running correctly. And my gosh, this is 50 years and nobody's mentioned this. So for those out there who think, well, you know, just about everything that has been everything has been written about Disney that could possibly ever be written about Disney, you need to realize that's not true. You know, even as I sit here talking to you guys, I'm looking at my bookshelves and I've got 3 dozen biographies about Walt Disney. And some of them are foreign. I've got a version from Russia that I got translated. So I've got 3 dozen biographies of Walt Disney. Not one of them have ever mentioned that.
That's so crazy. Well, I was looking at, you have a new book out, which we definitely want to get back to some of these like really fun stories that only you know. And I was thinking, we were talking like when I first read Vault of Walt and then 2, I was like, there's a second one. There's more information. I literally, like you said, I thought you had covered everything possible.
Jennifer, I'm going to blow your mind. I have just finished the manuscript for Volume 5.
That's what I saw. It's coming out this year, yeah? That's crazy.
Yeah, coming out in September. There's an entire chapter devoted just to the hands of Walt Disney.
Wow.
In fact, intriguing. His hands were so expressive that about 2-3 years before he passed away, his wife had a professional photographer take multiple pictures of just his hands.
That's so neat.
And they have copies of that at the Disney Family Museum. And one of the things in the chapter 2 is I found that a palm reader in 1938 did a palm reading of Walt Disney's hands without knowing that this was Walt Disney. And so I'm including all of those notes in that chapter as well.
That's fascinating. But what I was thinking, though, when you were talking, you have another book that at first I was reading. It seems like a departure from something. You know, obviously you'd be qualified to write this. It's called How to Be a Disney Historian. And as I was looking at the layout of the book and what all is in it, it's very much it could be getting started for media, you know, how to write, how to do media interviews. And of course, it seemed like something you were qualified to write. And I was wondering the inspiration, but you've just given us that so beautifully that there's so much history still when we go to the parks with our families, when we notice new things, when we talk to new people and have new experiences. And as Disney continues to write these stories, like we can continue to write them as well. And I think that's just absolutely a really incredible, just an incredible perspective from somebody that the rest of us feel like kind of knows everything, you know, like not in a bad way, not a know-it-all, but like I feel like you are the expert on all things Disney, and yet you are you're sitting here saying that we all need to help write this history, which is cool.
Oh gosh, there's so many stories that need to be told, and time is the enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, these things are slipping away. You know, we lost Jack Lindquist just recently, and he took with him so many stories that only he knew. You know, and he was the president of Disneyland, but he was the one who ran Holidayland in when Disneyland first opened. And he's the one who came up with the idea for Disney Dollars. And he came up with the idea for the Magic Kingdom Club and all that. And, you know, we often have a tendency to ask these people the same things. You know, I interviewed Ward Kimball several times. And sometimes I would just see him roll his eyes when somebody would ask him again, you know, how did you create Jiminy Cricket? Because Ward's feeling was, I've told that story 30 times. I really don't want to tell that story again. Now, Jennifer, one of the reasons I came up with How to Be a Disney Historian was, of course, when I was working for Disney, I often got a lot of people who wanted to know how to be a Disney animator or how to be a Disney Imagineer, you know, or I have a cousin on my mother's side who's, you know, who would be great sitting in a room coming up with ideas and all that. But in the last few years, I've been getting an awful lot of inquiries from well, how do you be a Disney historian? Do you need a degree in a certain area? Is there a test that you take? Is there a group of hooded figures who initiate you? How does this happen? And I thought, when I was just starting out, I would like to know, well, how do you start? Where do you go and find this material? And so I started to write down some of these notes, and then I thought, there's got to be more than just my experience. So as I said, I'm fortunately friends with an awful lot of other people, and so in the book there's 17 other people who are considered Disney historians. There's even a chapter by Dave Smith and the foreword by Leonard Maltin, but you got J.B. Kaufman, you got Jim Fanning, you got Michael Barrier, you got Brian Sibley, names that you've always seen on books. And I wrote to them and I said, look, if you had to give advice to somebody, what have you learned in your life? What are the tricks that you use, And I didn't let them see anything that I had written, and I didn't let them see anything that anybody else had written, because I knew that would influence them. Every single person I asked, their initial response was, well, I don't know what to say. I wouldn't know what to tell people. I'm really just learning myself. Mm. And so I had to convince them, yes, what you have is valuable. And I then had to convince my publisher to publish the book, because again, we weren't expecting, huge sales, how to be a Disney historian. As you pointed out, Jennifer, some of the material in the book is valuable for other areas, if you were writing or researching other things, if you were a Civil War historian, material that's in the book here is still valid in terms of doing that. And so, because the Vault of Walt books are selling so well, and some of the other books that I put together, he was willing to give me, my publisher was willing to give me sort of a get-out-of-jail-free pass. And he says, we'll do this one, but you've got to keep the costs down. It can't be any more than X number of pages. We can't have any artwork on the cover. We got to keep the costs down. But if you do that, we'll do this. And so I went full bore, and I thought, okay. And then, of course, immediately, as soon as the book came out, I thought, oh, should have talked about this. Oh, my gosh. We should. But as I said, I've received a couple of emails from young people who said, thank you so much for this book. I'm stumbling around, and I didn't know, and this gave me so many ideas and so many other things to think about. And I think this is important because those of us who are in the book, none of us are getting any younger, and there needs to be a new generation and also a higher standard. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because I get so distressed where I see that there's so much cut and paste going on. That when people talk about Cinderella's castle, they're all repeating the exact same things, and sometimes in the exact same words, and there's so much more about Cinderella Castle and the experience of Cinderella Castle, but everybody's just going back to all of this stuff, or they're just going to Wikipedia and feeling, well, this is the source. This must be true because it's in print. So I think we need a whole new generation of Disney historians who use multiple sources, who credit those sources, and who bring their own perspectives. Mm. I've talked with so many who just moan, well, you got to talk to Ward Kimball, but Ward Kimball's gone, and I'll never be able to talk to. And I said, Disney history is happening right now. Yeah. Frozen happened in your lifetime. That's the highest grossing Disney animated film of all time. You were there. You saw the audience reaction in theaters. You heard people being interviewed, you know, on TV shows and all of that. That's never going to happen again.
Yeah.
Write down that, you know. When you go to the Disney parks, you know, it's just so sad. Disney Hollywood Studios is one of my favorite studios because it's such an intimate experience. It also mimics in its design Disneyland, and so many things that were there when the park opened in 89 aren't there anymore. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, they took down the Earful Tower overnight.
Yeah.
It's there one day, the next morning you come, it's gone.
Yeah, we were sad about that. we didn't know that one. Well, as you're saying,
we were definitely sad about that.
I know. As you're talking, I'm even thinking about some of the cast members that we've met. And right now they hold, even if they're in like a managerial position or not, like they might hold not a super important role in with regards to like the hierarchy of the company.
Mm-hmm.
But someday they might, or they just have a cool story to tell. And you know, a lot of people that you talk to later especially started out, you know, doing kind of odd jobs around the parks or what have you. So you just never know what kind of things you're writing down, what they're going to end up, you know, turning into, which is really cool.
Well, so, and that's so true too, that those frontline cast members really see what is going on, you know? And again, you're right. They have that story where maybe they saw a celebrity or maybe they know why something is there. You know, sometimes it's there because of finances. You know, for instance, at Wilderness Lodge Resort, they had this very fancy coffee stand there in the morning. And the reason they have that is not just because they found that guests liked coffee, but Imagineers came one day and they saw that people were taking folding tables and putting them out to put the coffee there to satisfy the guests' need. And so the Imagineers said, if you're going to have something, then we have to have something that is themed into the experience. So we keep people immersed into this feeling of being in a lodge, you know? And again, none of this stuff, because at Disney, things happen so quickly. There's often very little time, you know, to document them, or things will change. And, you know, the sea serpent that's in the pool at Port Orleans is called Scales because the person who named it, Greg Erbar, not just because of the scales on the sea serpent, but because of musical scales, because he's very interested in Disney music, and basically the sea serpent is there is because the Aristocats took a cruise from France to New Orleans, and Scat Cat and his band was playing jazz, and so the sea serpent followed them and loved jazz so much that he stayed there. That's why you have those alligators playing jazz leading up into the pool. Now, 11 out of 10 Disney guests have no idea about that story. And again, it doesn't affect anything at all. But when you know it, it just sort of enhances the experience. But you won't know that unless you talk to the people. Because again, things change. You know, somebody came in and said, "Oh, let's do this." We have those gateways into. I was here when that happened. I was at the Disney Institute. You have those gateways that go into Disney property that have, you know, the big two-dimensional Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse, because at the time, 1996, Michael Ovitz's wife said, "I can't tell when I'm on Disney property." And so that's why they came up with those archways right there in front of Hotel Plaza Boulevard on the road leading into the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah.
That's why those were there, to define where Disney property began and ended. There's stories behind all of these things, and these are, you know, just exciting. But again, they're getting lost because people are passing away. The people who are involved, you know, aren't there. None of it got, you know, written down. And, you know, and then what happens is if you don't know the story, you start to make up stories. And we see that with cast members. I was a Walt Disney World cast member. I love Walt Disney World cast members. I some of them really work so hard to keep the magic alive. But sometimes when they don't know something, they make up something to fill in a gap. You know, I think a lot of times I hear from people, well, a bus driver told me this, and I go, that's not quite right. You know, there's a part of that that's right. But, you know, either they misheard it or they put two and two together and came up with five or whatever. So, you know, it's so important to get these things down. And so, you know, that's why I'm so excited to one of the reasons I'm so excited to be on the Disney Nerds podcast is you guys get it right. And you guys don't go and hit the same old, same old. You find different things, you know, to share so that there's an added perspective. And so I'm hoping that How to Be a Disney Historian, which people can get on Amazon.com or ThemeParkPress.com, I'm hoping a book like that is going to encourage more people to go out and do those things. You know, in fact, a good friend of mine, Werner Weiss, sometimes it's irritating going to the theme parks with him because within the first hour, he's taken 300 photos. And you can do that now because of digital cameras and all of that. And I go, Werner, really? And then it always trips me up because things change, but Werner is the one who's got the picture of the sign. Werner is the one who's got the picture of the exit of the attraction, whatever, that is no longer there. And it's like, thank you, Werner, for doing that. Yeah.
Lots of pictures come back with me, that's for sure. My camera is full. So Jim, you mentioned that you were a cast member. Now, we know that you relocated to Florida in 1995-ish. You caught on mm-hmm. with the balloon animals at Treasure Island, which is pretty interesting, and then went on to be some pretty interesting characters in the parks. What are some of your early stories of people?
Well, you know, the funny thing is again, I'm from Glendale, and I was an annual pass holder at Disneyland, and again, I knew Dave Smith, so I was, you know, helping with some material and things like that, and of course, the biggest joke out in California was I was the most Disney person that people knew, but I was not working for Disney. I actually worked at Six Flags Magic Mountain. I actually did Tiny Toons comic books for Warner Brothers, but I wasn't doing anything Disney. And so my parents were ill, and so I moved out to Florida in fall of 1995 to take care of them. And I was doing all sorts of jobs, and the first one, as you mentioned, was at Pleasure Island. I was doing balloon animals and magic for drunk college students who were throwing up in the street, and you know, some of them were urinating off the bridges. You know, people don't forget how exciting Pleasure Island was. And then I moved over. I auditioned, and I moved over to Magic Kingdom, where I assisted in the portrayal of Merlin the Magician doing the Sword in the Stone ceremony, looking for the new temporary ruler of Fantasyland. And I had to learn to handle pigeons, because at one point Merlin releases the pigeon to find the new temporary ruler, and he's looking somewhere else. But if he chooses you, don't worry. And I'd brush off my shoulder, you'll know. And they had to stop doing that because hawks started gathering around the top of Cinderella's castle, figuring, gee, you know, every hour on the hour, we've got a snack heading our way. And then on the weekends, I was over in Frontierland as Brash Picture Bat, an old gold miner. My golly, we're all going to do a gold dance. Get together here in the line. And I had a little raccoon puppet that actually looked like a real raccoon. And it had a spring in it, so you could manipulate it. So suddenly it would jump at somebody, or it would go right up their arm. You know, what is that real? Is that, you know, no, Disney's not going to do that. But while I was doing that, I relocated over to the Disney Institute because I had a background in animation. And so I ended up teaching all of the animation classes, computer animation and hand-drawn animation and how to paint a cell and how to do Disney voices and history of animation. And I just thought the Disney Institute was the greatest thing in the entire world, and I figured that's where I was going to be for the rest of my life, and that's terrific. But as everyone knows, the Disney Institute just kept reconfiguring. For one thing, it was Michael Eisner's idea, and there were people in the company who wanted to undercut that. And so as the Disney Institute kept shrinking, I moved over to Disney Adult Discoveries, which is the group that does the backstage tours like Backstage Magic, Hidden Treasures of World Showcase. And so I was writing tours. I was teaching others how to do tours. I was doing the tours myself. And then during the millennium, I moved over to Epcot, where I was working in guest relations because they brought me over there because they saw that I was writing and doing tours, and so they wanted a tour for Epcot. So I wrote the Undiscovered Future World tour. And I was only supposed to write a fourth of that. There were three other guest relations people, and they were supposed to write, you know, each write a section, and I was going to write a section. I wrote a section. I turned it in early. They looked at it, and they said, you're doing the rest of it. So I wrote the tour
first.
And again, this is very funny, Sam, because I absolutely hated Epcot. Hated it. I thought it was cold. I thought it was uninteresting. All of that. And my part of the tour was the beginning of the tour, which was the history of Epcot and then Spaceship Earth and, you know, the front portion of that. And as I researched, I fell in love with Epcot because I started to understand why certain choices were being made, why certain things were there, you know, that and the background behind some of this and the design that John Hench came up for Spaceship Earth, because nobody had made, and nobody has since, a geodesic sphere. They'd made geodesic domes, but not a geodesic sphere, because you can't balance it. And Hench, my God, and what a wonderful person. John Hench learned to read palms, but he would only read the palms of girls who were 20 years old. He would not, when you said, well, Mr. Hench, could you read my, oh, I'm tired right now, I'm not going to do that. But what Hench came up with was you create a table and you put 3/4 of the circle on top of the table and the other 1/4 underneath the table.
Thanks.
And there's a gutter around the equator, so when it rains, water goes into that gutter, doesn't fall down the sides of that, and then the water funnels through the sphere, and it goes through those legs that are supporting it, and right out to the World Showcase Lagoon. So as I'm researching this, I'm getting more and more excited and interested, so they pulled me over to guest relations to more or less, you know, handle the tour, train people, keep it up to date, all that, as well as the regular guest relations things. And then they moved me over to college and international programs because I'm a certified teacher. I was teaching junior high, and I was teaching college classes out in California. And I ended up teaching 250 different classes that I created because the international students had to have classes so they could maintain the special visa they have, the Mickey Mouse visa they have that was created just for international students. And part of the requirement for that was that they were supposed to have education in all these other different areas. And college students needed to take certain classes so that they would get credit for that semester that they were spending. So I was teaching all of those classes. And then they moved me over to the Disney Learning Center, which was sort of like a computer lab, and it was a huge library, and you had guest speakers come in, and I did presentations. And you need to realize that sometimes older cast members have a challenge with computers. I had ones who picked up a mouse and tried to use it like a remote control. I had, you know, and more things, especially at Disney, were on computers now. You know, they have the hub, which is their intranet. And so if you want to request time off for whatever, you've got to go through the computer. So I was helping people with that. And then one day, while I'm doing this, and I'm ordering supplies for the site, one of the big executives of Epcot appears in the doorway and says, "Jim, could I talk to you for a minute?" And I thought, well, okay, this isn't unusual. I get pulled out all the time. I was writing things for executives, you know, about Disney history that, again, they would stick their name on and put, you know, in a Disney publication, or I was actually helping. There were negotiations going on with Russia for a pavilion, and I was helping by showing all the different Disney connections with Russia, including the very first Russian Mickey Mouse comic book and all that. So they can you see? And I said, oh, and they said, okay, and make sure you turn off your computer before you come. And I thought, oh yeah, the safety thing, because you don't want somebody to play with your computer if you're not there. And I went to the door, and they were already down the hall. And I thought, oh, they just want to talk down there because they don't want it coming into the site where these people are. And I went down and then turned a corner. Suddenly I'm in a room. There's this little guy with glasses behind the desk. The woman who brought me in there said, "We'd like to thank you for everything that you have done for Disney, but your role is being eliminated." Mm-hmm. And she left the room, and this guy goes, "We need your ID, and we have security to escort you out to your car." I said, "Wait a minute. Let me take a minute here to, you know," because the year before, I had just won the Partners in Excellence Award, which is given to the top 5%, you know, of the people who work at Walt Disney World. You have to go through this long process, and there's three different committees you have to go through in order to get that, and here they're saying, "I'm sorry, your role is no longer there." That week, Disney eliminated, that was what, 2009? They eliminated 3,000 people at Walt Disney World in 1 week.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. And I didn't get angry. Because I always tell people, you can love the Disney brand, you can love, you know, the characters, the experience you have in the park, but you can still have concerns about how the Disney business operates.
Sure.
And so that's how I approached it. And I applied for other jobs. I got an outside vendor number, so I write for the Disney Vacation Club magazine, Disney Files. I wrote for the Mickey Insider, you know, various things like that. And Disney was fine to have me do that as long as they didn't have to pay health benefits or retirement or anything like that. And I still hold no hard feelings for that, but I thought my career was going to be at Disney. In fact, I have two brothers who work at Disney. And both of them were laid off that week, but were able to get back into the company. My brother, Chris, works merchandising. He was at ESPN and determining which merchandise goes to which location. My brother, Mike, started as a performer, Streetmosphere, at Disney Hollywood Studios, and now he is the casting manager for Walt Disney World. So people come and audition for the Indiana Jones stunt show and all of that, and it's my brother Mike who is helping make those decisions. My brothers, and I love them dearly, and I've actually performed with them. We were on the Gong Show as the Quasimodo Belairs, singing, dancing hunchbacks.
Oh, my goodness.
Quasimodo, do you know who's going to win the
Hold
third
on,
race?
Right
no, but
now.
I got a hunch.
Oh, my goodness.
And I we were also on the dating game, so there were three of us, and the girl was a stunt woman from Universal Studios Hollywood, and it was a nice dress she was almost wearing. So I'm very close with my brothers. They have never read any book I have ever written. I mention them in every book. They have never read any book because they're just not interested in reading.
You should just start telling bad stories about
them. They will come up to me and they'll say, you know, at work, this person came up and they said, you know, your brother just wrote this fantastic thing on this website. And they go, oh, well, that's nice. But they have no curiosity to go and look.
So that's the difference between a Disney nerd and a Disney fan, I guess, right? A Disney
yeah.
nerd,
yes.
you want to drill
yes.
into all that.
That's exactly it. And again, even if you're talking about a Disney nerd, that covers a wide variety. You know, I know some
sure.
Disney nerds who are only interested in pins
yeah.
or only interested in Vinylmation or only interested in the parks or only interested in Disneyland. You know, or only interested in animation, or only interested in the animation that they grew up with. You know, so Disney nerds.
So your story
covers a wide swath there.
Absolutely, and your stories tend to be that wide swath of
yes.
everything.
Mm-hmm.
But you know,
and again, it's because I have an interest and an expertise in. All of these areas. As I said, I had an interest in cartooning and animation, so when I write about Disney animation, I'm coming from that standpoint where I can talk about, you know, I understand the line of action, I understand drawing through the shape, but the trick is to make that understandable to people who don't. When I talk about Disney entertainment, I come, you know, from a background of I performed on stage and in film and I will tell you that when I was going to Occidental College, I actually appeared in a Disney this is an exclusive for Disney nerds. I appeared in a Disney educational film. And the reason for that is because the person who was the lead in that was Christina Anderson. And Christina Anderson's father was Bill Anderson, who was a big producer at Disney, and so she wanted to get into the business, so he arranged for her to be in this film, and I got a supporting role in there. Nobody knows the title. I don't even have a copy of it.
Oh my goodness.
But at least Disney Nerds Podcast know I was in a Disney film. And
you
I
know
played
the
part.
Question.
I played the part of Emmett. Men have died and worms have eaten them, but not for love. Oh, I'm Emmett.
Oh my goodness!
So this
is
going to drive people crazy because I've tried to track down to get a copy of this film. And again, I'm in it for that space that, you know, if you blink or you don't look in the background, you know, you're not going to see me. But I was so when I talk about Disney films, I'm coming from an understanding of how is the film made, how all of this, and I just have a curiosity about so many things. And so that's why I'm constantly broke, because all these great books are coming out, and, you know, I'm interested in Flash Gordon. I'm interested in the original King Kong. I've got books and magazines on all of it. I'm interested in Laurel and Hardy. I'm interested in vaudeville. And so, you know, oh, well. You know, my dad said, listen, Jim, when you get to heaven, one of the things that's going to make it heaven is they're going to have a huge library of all the books that were ever written, all the books that are ever going to be written, and all of the books that should have been written but never were. And you're going to have all the time in the world to read them.
That's really cool. And you won't have to pay a dime.
Nice.
Yeah.
So something that you were in that I was able to track video down of that I can share in the show notes is you appeared in the 100 Years of Magic Vacation Planning DVD. Well, take it back.
Yes.
Planning VHS.
Oh, my goodness.
It was not a DVD. And you introduced some fascinating things that were going to be coming to MGM Studios for the 100th birthday celebration of Walt.
Absolutely. And you know that was shot at 2 a.m. in the morning in the animation pavilion. Because it had,
in the pavilion.
It had to be shot. Yeah, it had to be shot before, after the cleaning crew had done their cleaning, and then you had to set up all of these cameras and things like this, and then you had to make sure you were out of there before guests came into the park. In fact, my dress rehearsal for Merlin, since it had to be done in the park, was at 3 a.m. in the morning, but I had to show up at midnight because it took a good hour for them to get me into that makeup and costume in the first place before I could trot out there. And then there were all sorts of other things going on. So there's things happening at Disney 24/7.
That's so cool.
I remember being scared to death when I worked at Epcot because I was there late one night. And I was walking around the World Showcase Lagoon, and there was this huge explosion. And you know, you could see the light. You could feel the heat. What is it? Well, on the Inferno Barge, if they have any gas left, they have to blow it out before they move it backstage for safety reasons. Nobody had ever told me this. So it's the dead of night. There's nobody there. I'm wandering around.
And the park
blew
up, yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, the park has blown up.
What do I do?
And they're going to blame me.
Oh, my goodness. That's so funny.
So yes, I was the narrator for, the 100 Years of Magic. And on YouTube, I did, shortly after they laid me off, I did two videos for Disney. One was on Walt's love of steam trains, and the other was on the costumes for the Christmas celebration at Epcot. So people can look that up on YouTube, and
they'll find links to that and include it.
Yes, or I'll try and send. I think I've got the links. I can send them to you. But yes, those were two things where I researched it, I wrote it, and then I was the on-camera talent. And on the steam trains, it's very funny. The person who had commissioned it was sitting there looking at this with the guy who directed it, and he goes, I don't think he's reading off of cue cards, is he? And the director said, no. He says he wrote the script. He knew what he was talking about. He's just talking.
Oh, that you're just passionate about it. Yeah.
So you
yes, but I was on the Gong Show. I was on the Dating Game. I was on Family Feud.
Ooh, I love
I was on a I was on a show called Camouflage where I won a red Cadillac.
Wow.
One of the reasons I did game shows is because I was in the union, and so whether you won or not, they paid you scale, which is the minimum amount that an actor gets. So as a starving actor, this was great. And they loved having me because I would take direction. Because they can't tell you what to do, but they can come in and go, gosh, you know, 2 weeks ago it was just great. The guy who won this, he jumped up and down and he kissed the car. And so if you're smart, in the back of your mind, you're going, if I win, they want me to jump up and down and kiss the car.
That's so funny.
And in fact, I was on some shows that never aired. One was called Origins, which is the about the origins of phrases and words. And I won because I knew the origin of ham actor. Again, because of my entertainment background. Because in the days of the melodramas and all of that, there wasn't pancake makeup. Actors used grease paint. And those who are listening, if you've ever had grease paint on, you know that it goes on wet and it stays wet, you know, so you can't touch your makeup and whatever. And it's oil-based, so it's a pain in the butt to try and get off. And so in the old days, actors would take ham rind to clear off all of the oil from their skin. So they would go into the local saloon smelling of ham. And so these melodramatic actors were called ham actors. Isn't this amazing?
Paint, but I didn't know that its origin. That's really cool. The things you learn.
Again, I was a junior high school teacher, so I just fall in love with the sound of my own voice. Are there things you'd like to ask?
Here's the one that I have, Jim. And this goes back to when you were on the 100 Years of Magic VHS.
There were three
things you introduced. You introduced the Stars and Motor Carts Parade.
I loved that.
And you introduced, for the first time I ever heard, that there was going to be a 12-story tall hat, sorcerer's hat,
yes,
in front of Hollywood. You introduced that to the world, by the way. And listen,
they told me it was temporary.
Right.
They told me it was only going to last for 1 year.
That was exactly what my question was going to be. Then the third thing you introduced.
And then I went out and I saw them building it, and I thought, they're digging those supports pretty deep, and they're pouring in concrete. This is going to be a pain to get rid of in a year.
A lot of work for 1 year.
And it was 16 years later, or whatever it ended up becoming.
Yes, yes.
You also introduced the concept for One Man's Dream.
Oh, gosh.
Absolutely.
And I love that. I love that original attraction. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that. Did you have any involvement in that? You were obviously a historian working for the company. You had to have been in your element introducing that.
Yes, yes. And so I was waiting. I sent emails and all of that. But at that particular point, I didn't have the right color ID. Disney cast member's ID is blue now. But in those days, there were different colors. There was yellow, there was red, there was green. It all meant different things. And even though I had a blue ID, which meant upper management and salaried and all that, when I was at the Disney Institute, when I moved to Epcot, I got demoted to office and technical. So I had a yellow ID. And so I was told by Disney University at Walt Disney World that I was not qualified to work on any projects because I had a yellow ID. Only those with blue IDs knew what they were doing.
Oh, boy.
And so it's like, really? But you know what? Imagineering still contacted me to have me do some work for them, and I did some stuff for the Disney Cruise Lines and all that. And then the manager at Disney University would call me. I remember this to this day, and I get a shiver down my spine. Would have me sit, and she purposely got a chair that was lower than her desk for me to sit in. So I was sitting there, and she was trying to explain to me every single time how that was inappropriate. And I said, but they contacted me, and I'm doing this on my free time. time.
Right.
You know,
this is
inappropriate.
Right,
don't you ever do that again. Which is one of the reasons I probably got laid off, because it was a pain in the butt. You know, if Imagineering came up and said, look, we've got a deadline the end of this week. Do you know how? Absolutely. So I'd write the text on the back of trading cards for the Magic Kingdom, because they needed, you know, that done, and they needed it done quickly, and they needed somebody who could summarize something in two sentences.
So
and
are
then,
you talking
sure enough, a week later, I'm in that little chair, and if somebody asks you, you're supposed to say no. I said, aren't we all supposed to help each other?
Yes.
And it was at that point that I realized that it's not just one big Happy Magic Kingdom. It's a bunch of separate fiefdoms that all report to the same king. And sometimes those fiefdoms want to undercut other fiefdoms so that they look better. You know, but it is what it is. I had a wonderful experience. I have wonderful memories. I'm glad I worked at Disney. I'm proud of having worked at Disney. I'm happy that Disney still, you know, wants me to do stuff. But here's an example of how silos can happen. Last year, Disneyland flew me out to Disneyland to talk to the cast members about Disney and the Asian Pacific heritage. And they put me up at the Grand Californian for 2 days. They gave me passes to Disneyland and Disney California Adventure. They gave me priority seating for the Worlds of Color show, all of that. They flew me out. They put me up on it. They flew me back. I wrote to Walt Disney World, I explained this, and I said, you know, I live in Orlando. You wouldn't have to pay transportation. You wouldn't have to pay for lodging. You wouldn't have to pay for food. The presentation is already done. I could come and do this for you. And the response I got was, thank you so much for offering. You know, if we are interested, we will contact you.
That's so strange. Yeah, yeah, it's
a prophet.
It's a big company.
A prophet has no honor in his own land.
Oh gosh, you're kidding.
You know, it is what it is. You have to laugh. It's just, I always tell people that Disney is a company where the right hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
That's really funny.
You know, and again, everybody is very, very concerned about, you know, status and, you know, is this right to have somebody here do this? And you know, in Walt's day, and I've talked to so many Disney legends and old timers, Walt never had any of that. You know, Ward Kimball said, you know, Walt was a producer, a studio head. He said, you couldn't go up to Jack Warner and say, hi, Jack, or whatever. You had to talk to somebody who talked to somebody who talked to somebody who talked to his secretary, whatever. With Walt, you could go right up to Walt. Walt would even come down to your office. You didn't have to come up to his.
And sit in the little chair.
You know? Yeah, Walt's feeling was, you know, we've got a job to do. Who can do it? You know, when he was doing animated films, he would take suggestions from anyone. The studio gardener would hand in gags because you could get, you know, $5 for a gag that was used in an animated cartoon. And in those days, the weekly salary was $12 or $15. So the gardener kept turning in all of these gags. Not all of them were accepted, but a lot of them were. And Ward said, I went to Walt and I said, gee, you should pull up Pete to the story department. And he said, Walt looked at me and said, and what, lose a good gardener? He's a great gardener. I don't want to do that.
But that's the culture that was created in which you could then call somebody up in the Glendale phone book, and they just wanted to help mm-hmm. and share the story and share the information. And
they did.
Plug you
they
in.
Did. They, and they loved telling the story. They loved yeah. being asked because, you know, their family was burned out hearing
sure.
all of these stories. And to have somebody so eagerly going, well, tell me about this, tell me about that, you yeah. know. And even to this day, I find that that's true. I helped Sully Sullivan write a book of his memoirs. And by golly, he just, you know, once you got him going, he just loved telling those stories, you know, but you had to prime the pump. You had to know names of people that he might have known, or incidents that happened, or have photos, you know, from the time period. And once you did that, boy, that just, because again, if somebody asked me, what did I have for lunch two Sundays ago? I have no clue.
Me neither.
And here I'm asking these people, well, 40 years ago, what were you thinking when Frank Thomas, you know, came into the room?
Right. This might not be the, a lot of our listeners are Disney nerds, obviously. They like to dig into the story, they like the history, but we have new listeners that come, you know, on and off all the time, new people that come into the Facebook group. And if someone maybe is a casual park goer or, you know, just started visiting Disney World or Disneyland, they're kind of like interested in this story that the company tells and all its rich history, like, but obviously it's vast, as you, I mean, as we've determined, you have almost five Vault of Waltz, and those felt inclusive. So it's this huge history of tons of great stories. Where should someone even start if they just kind of want to see what the Disney company and its history and stories are all about?
Okay, I always recommend the Bob Thomas book, Walt Disney and American Original. Came out in 1976, and Bob had was a reporter for the Associated Press. He had complete access to everybody at Disney, some of which are long gone now, and complete access to the Disney family. And so this is a really good, solid biography of Walt and what was going on in his mind. And again, it's not a whitewash. You know, Bob mentions things like Walt's nervous breakdown and things like that, but he doesn't dwell on them in a tabloid fashion. You know, it's just a fact that happened, and you know, you go on to this and all of that. So if you want to get a start with Walt Disney, that's a good book to start with, and one that is accurate and you can count on. You know, some of these others aren't. You know, there's the Neil Gabler book out, which is, you know, hundreds of pages, but even though there's good stuff in there, one of the things that Gabler does, and he did this on the PBS documentary as well, is he starts to make assumptions. He starts to psychoanalyze Walt. Well, this is what Walt must have been thinking, and this is what Walt must have been feeling. And it's like, you didn't know Walt. And people who I've talked to who knew Walt told me, we had no idea what he was thinking. You know, we would go in and would go, he approved this last time, so he'll approve this, and then he didn't, you know? And I remember Sully saying, you know, we came in with plans for parking for Walt Disney World, and we thought, you know, we took the parking at Disneyland and extrapolated, and we did all of this research, and Walt said he slammed his hand down on the table and scared me to death. He says, you're thinking too small. Get out of here. And you know, you never knew. But so this would be a good book on Walt. A good book on Walt Disney World, of course, is Jeff Curdy's book, Since the World Began. But that only goes up to the opening of Disney MGM Studios. I'm going to be immodest and suggest that a book that I wrote, and I wrote specifically for this, that people wanted to know stories behind Walt Disney World, is Secret Stories of Walt Disney World. You know, there's a ton of books out there, Hidden Secrets, all of these different things. But I thought, boy, a lot of this is just the same old, and some of this is wrong or some of this has changed. And so I sat down and I thought, I'm going to write a book. People really don't have time these days to sit down and read an 800-page book, so I'm going to divide it up into two-page stories. And I'm going to cover the parks. I'm going to cover the resorts. I'm going to cover the things that are outside of the resorts, like the casting center and Blizzard Beach and, you know, all of the things that were behind that. And then I'm going to have a section devoted to Walt Disney World history. And all. And here's an exclusive for you, Jennifer. You and Sam, here's another Disney Nerds podcast. Right. I am three-quarters through the second edition of More Secrets of Walt Disney World.
Oh, yay.
And this will be coming out by December. It's going to take me the summer to finish it, but the original book contained almost 100 stories, plus that introductory chapter. This new book, the introductory chapter, is going to explain about Reedy Creek, because I find that a lot of people really don't understand Reedy Creek.
Yeah.
And it's going to cover Stolport, and it's going to cover Walt's plans for an international airport, which was going to be right where Celebration is now. And, you know, right across the street, that was going to be the main entrance into Epcot. That's why that building there that houses entertainment on Sherbert Road there, houses entertainment and Disney Design Group, why it's called Main Gate. I don't know if you know that, but there's a building there, and it houses those different divisions. It's called Main Gate because that was going to be the main gate into Epcot property. And that's why Magic Kingdom's at the top of the property, because Walt wanted people to drag people right through the entire property. They'd have to go through Epcot to get to the Magic Kingdom, and after they left the Magic Kingdom, they'd have to go through Epcot again. So he's forcing them to experience Epcot. So that's going to be out there. There really needs, and again, as much as I like secret stories of Walt Disney World, and a lot of people have been buying that and like that, that's why another... If you vote with your wallet, more books come.
That's right.
That's why the sequel's coming out in December here. There really needs to be a good book about Walt Disney World, because there's dozens about Disneyland, but Walt Disney World has always been treated like an orphan. And I never understood that, because you've got four theme parks, you got a couple dozen resorts, you got all these other, you know, vacation destination things, horseback riding, golfing, but nobody, you know, has sat down and really gone through this. And this year we're celebrating an anniversary, right?
Yeah, of
just as we finish up the 60th of and that's the book that's coming out end of June. I just finished the proofs on that, the unofficial Disneyland 1955 companion. And in that book, it started out where I thought, and I started this 2.5 years ago, I thought, gee, the Disneyland 60th anniversary is coming up. In 35 years, I've interviewed a lot of people who worked at Disneyland in 1955. How easy a book is this going to be? I just grab a couple of these interviews and I stick them in the book, right? This is what Disneyland was like. But as soon as I put the interviews in there, I started to realize, well, I better explain what that is, and I better explain who those are, and I better explain what... So it took 2.5 years, but it's coming out, and it just covers Disneyland. It's 250 pages. It just covers Disneyland in its first 6 months, and much of it is told in the voice of those people who were there. So, for instance, there's an entire chapter devoted to the woman who played Snow White on opening day.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So I have a whole interview with her about what that experience was like. And then again, some of the usual suspects. So you've got Ron Dominguez in there talking. You've got all of these people. I've got individual chapters devoted to each of the lands. So the Main Street chapter has the original description that Walt had for Main Street. Then it lists all of the stores, who are the managers of the stores, all of the attractions, whether it was an A ticket, a B ticket, or a C ticket, and then behind the scenes stories of those attractions, like the Upjohn Pharmacy that had a live jar of leeches in it, because doctors in the turn of the century would use leeches to pull out, you know, bad blood. And something that you won't find anywhere else, that whole Upjohn Pharmacy that got removed from Disneyland in 1970 is now at the University of Tucson.
Oh, wow.
They
wow.
recreated the entire store with all of the same you know, equipment that was there, because it belonged to the Upjohn Pharmacy. And Donald Gilmore was the president of Upjohn and a friend of Walt's. So Walt sold him the car from the Gnome-mobile, plus the back seat that was done up four times the size of the back seat. So, you know, a full-size actor could sit on there and he looked like a gnome. He sold it to Donald Gilmore in Kalamazoo, Michigan, for his car museum, just for the cost of shipping from California to Kalamazoo. So all of that is in the book, plus more. You know, the Eddie Little Sky, who was the Indian in the Indian village. And all. So we have all of that in there. We have a chapter devoted. We have a whole chapter devoted just to the Mickey Mouse Club Circus. And again, I have a background, I hate to tell you this, as a circus performer. I was a circus clown.
Oh, there's a whole nother show.
That's right.
For mud shows and all that. So I was able to contact some of these people from the old circuses who performed for the Mickey Mouse Club Circus.
Wow.
And then I also talked with Mouseketeers like Lonnie Burr and Bobby Burgess who were there. Mm-hmm. So again, this covers Disneyland in 1955, 250 pages. I have enough material on the cutting room floor for another volume of this.
Hopefully that'll be down the pipe soon, or eventually.
But again, you know, if a book doesn't sell, you don't get the sequel. Book of Mouse, I'm very proud of that book, covers all of Mickey Mouse, has a complete filmography of Mickey Mouse. I had enough material for a sequel. I had enough material for a Donald Duck book, just Ducky.
Oh.
But Book of Mouse did not sell well enough that, you know, yes, if I live to be as old as Methuselah, these books will get written. But they're not getting written right now because nobody seems to be interested in buying them. So,
well, we'll try.
You
got to
vote
that
with your wallet.
Well, and I think just hearing you talk, hopefully, I mean, I like I said, I think that your name is a household name among Disney nerds, if nothing else. But just hearing the stories that you tell, hopefully every single one of our listeners will go out and buy your whole library of books. That would be wonderful, because I found a couple that I don't have, and I need to try to track them down. So. This has just been really wonderful.
That's right. And then you can go track down the animation books that I wrote when I lived out in California.
That's right.
And how to create animation, where I interviewed people like Glenn Keane and all of that about Disney animation.
Nice.
Mike Giamo about working on Roger Rabbit, things like that. So, and I do this for a couple of reasons. First off, I think it's important to record these stories and share these stories. And I know that that's one of the reasons behind the Disney Nerds podcast. But also there's that fear of time is the enemy, that this stuff is slipping away, and I have a responsibility to the people who shared these stories with me to get those stories out there so that they're not lost. And then on top of that, in 2009, Disney laid me off, and nobody wanted to hire me to say, do you want fries with that? So I had to start writing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how I almost pay my bills, is through all of this writing. So thank heavens that I'm able to do that. Thank heavens that there are people who are interested in reading all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I've already got books planned for 2017. So in end of June, Unofficial Disneyland 1955 Companion comes out. Over the summer, towards the end of September, Vault of Walt Volume 5 comes out. And in December, more secret stories of Walt Disney World.
That is exciting.
And, yeah, I've been writing for 35 years. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is already written. I just need to pull it out, update it, you know, enlarge on some of it, make corrections, and there's the material. One of these days I'll run out of that stuff, but
then I'll
write about what it was like being on the Gong Show and what Chuck Barris was really like.
Circus performer. I was gonna say, I feel like you could tell stories for a very long time.
And the so circus good. Skills and, yeah. And meeting Hubby Burgess, who means nothing to you guys, but one of your listeners may go, Hubby Burgess, he's a legend of the circus.
Oh,
and you met him, you know, or talk about my time working with Disney on Ice, where I actually had to do character integrity talks because they were sticking Baloo with Turk from Tarzan because they both came from jungles. So I had to explain to them how that doesn't work.
That's so funny. I was going to say, I thought you were going to say that you also skated. I was going to say, my goodness, what don't you do?
No. I've done a lot of interesting things in my life. I worked at the Los Angeles Zoo where I almost killed Mayor Bradley by accident.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Okay. I
worked in... traveling magic shows like the Dr. Silkini show. I worked at Six Flags Magic Mountain as a performer, and I also wrote and directed shows there. As I said, I wrote comic books. I wrote Tiny Toon comic books. You'll actually find my name in Marvel Comics and DC Comics as a character.
What?
So in one of the and a Hanna-Barbera character. A comic where I'm suspected as being the secret identity of the Blue Falcon. And I did comic strips for a couple of LA newspapers,
so
things
Falcon?
Like that. So I never knew which job I was going to be out of work from. All of those jobs were to impress women. They were never impressed, so I moved on to something else. It never occurred to me I should learn to play a guitar. It never occurred to me that I should get a fast car, you know? No, I was doing magic. I was doing art.
I love it.
What a waste. What a waste.
No. Because we all need to go buy your books. Everyone listening needs to go buy all of Jim's books. But hopefully it's a little bit of consolation that you have brought just hours of entertainment and joy and excitement to so many people. So I hope that helps a little bit. I know it doesn't pay the bills.
it does. Thank you so much. Because again, as a writer, you work and you work in a solitary fashion. Mm. So you assume that people like it because people keep asking you to do more, but you just don't know, you know, and I try to put myself in the role of the reader, you know, so sometimes I over-explain things because I figured, well, you know, and you guys must run into that where you go to the parks and you know things, but other people don't. And so you're trying to explain to somebody why something is so amazing.
There's a rumor
they have no
that
clue.
Sam,
they have no context.
There's a rumor that Sam has told everyone multiple times the Illuminations backstory, whether they wanted to hear it or not, but we enjoy it. I agree with you. I know. Well,
you know, and again, you know, even if it's a story I've heard before, I love hearing it from other people because sometimes it's a different perspective or sometimes, you know, you find something new. And again, I tell people, don't assume I know everything. Treat me as dumb as dirt, you know, because I don't want you to go, oh, well, he probably already knows that, you know, and then I'll miss it forever because maybe I won't. So one of the Disney nerds going to put together their book.
Oh, I don't know. We should work on that, huh? We have a lot of stories, so.
That's a great question.
Yeah, not only do you have a lot of stories, you could just transcribe some of those interviews that you've done.
That's exactly right.
So there's a hard copy of them.
That's very true. We should definitely get on that a lot sooner.
Grab some of your blog postings. There was that fascinating one of, is that a hidden Walt in Dumbo.
Yeah.
Is it? What do you think?
It very well could be. The problem was is at that time period, there were two or three other people who looked similar. But I'm going to assume that that probably was a hidden Walt, because the silhouettes of the clowns in Dumbo, you know, against the circus tent, those were parodies of Disney animators who were on strike at the time. We're going to hit the big boss up for a raise. So it would not have been unusual. A hidden Walt, of course, a very definite hidden Walt that has been verified, is the one in Ferdinand the Bull, the Matador, as he comes out. And all of the other little characters are caricatures of Disney animators. So Ham Lusk is in there. He's the little short, chubby guy coming out. But the Matador in that, that's Walt Disney.
That's very cool. Very, very cool.
Well, it's very cool being on Disney Nerds Podcast.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Don't hesitate to have me on anytime you want, and especially when the books come out, so I can promote those.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
I'm full of stories. I'm full of something. I hope it's stories. But, you know, and again, you know, maybe you've got listeners out there that go, I have questions I've always wanted to ask Jim Corcus. They can write it down, and we can do a whole podcast where we try to answer those questions. But remember, as I always tell people, as Dave Smith told me, nobody can know everything, especially about Disney. But for those of you who are listening, and those of you who have experience, but those of you, this is your first time getting involved with Disney, the Disney Nerds Podcast is a great place to start to keep that pixie dust alive.
Thank you so much
for having me.
It has been our pleasure and honor. Absolutely.
Make sure you check out the website, thedisneynerdpodcast.com, and we're looking forward to your feedback. Send your questions to questions@thedisneynerds.com. You can reach each of us, Sam, Jen, Jimmy, and Ed, at the Disney Nerds, the Facebook group, Disney Nerds. Thank you guys so much for the time. It's always great to get your feedback. And hey, iTunes, give us a review. We're always looking for that and ideas for future shows. So thank you so much, and Kongaloosh.
See ya.
If you would like to join our jamboree, there's a simple rule that's compulsory. Mortals pay a token fee. Rest in peace, the haunting's free. So hurry back.